couple of years back, I travelled to Longreach, you might remember, in central Queensland for Saturday Extra, to see how the community was dealing with that crippling drought that had officially begun in 2013. We'd heard about some of the local initiatives of people reinventing their lives and finding other ways to bring much-needed income to their farms, and how the community had rallied and continues to, by the way, raising funds to spread throughout the region. And the resilience was obvious, but also some pre-planning by veterans of the area who'd simply accepted the drought was part of their climate and that this went hand in hand with our farming experience. So when I came across a book curious about how farmers from the 1870s through to the 1950s dealt with drought, it quite piqued my interest, because it's not just about the business of farming, it's about life and death and the whole ambiguity of it all. Existential questions, really. Rebecca Jones, an environmental historian, researched and wrote Slow Catastrophes, Living with Drought in Australia, while she was a postdoctoral fellow in the School of History and the Centre for Environmental History at the ANU. She used the diaries of seven farmers and one memoir from the 1870s to delve beyond the obvious in how they dealt with drought, and also spoke to today's farmers about their attitude. So, Rebecca, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Hi, Geraldine.
This idea of using diaries from past farmers, where did this spring from?
Well, I was aware that there was diaries in public collections, and I'd always been interested in them. But when I started to become interested in drought and drought resilience, I wanted to hear what farmers and people in agricultural communities had to say for themselves, rather than having their stories mediated by government reports, inquiries, media, that kind of thing. I mean, they're useful, but I wanted to hear the voices of the farmers themselves, what they were doing, what they were feeling, what they were thinking every day, sort of day in, day out. And I thought, well, the best way to get at that is things like diaries.
Yes, and it's because when you read them, some incredibly moving, and your summaries of them, it's about light and soil and sky and place in a way. It's not just about the business of rainfall or absence of it.
Oh, not at all, no. I mean, most of the diaries that I looked at were considered to be farm diaries, so they did have all that practical information, which was terribly useful for me. But they also imbue their diaries with emotions and thoughts and feelings, and you get that kind of, it's a real sensual experience reading these diaries. You get that feeling of the dust and the heat and the and sometimes the rain, you know.
You have this beautiful line about the diaries: the curve of handwriting, incremental changes in the script, smudges, crossed out words and waning ink, all hint at thoughts forming, time passing, growth, change and decay. You must have become very attached to your diarist. Is there anyone who's particularly special to you?
I did become attached to them. My partner described them as my new friends. They sort of, I felt like they'd moved in with us. You know, reading diaries over that in some cases spanned 50 years, you really do feel like you've got to know them. You know, you feel like there's a very intimate connection with these people. Look, I think, I don't know, I became fond of all of them. I think two of my favourite would have to be Charles Coote.
Yes, I thought you might say that.
Yes, he lived in the Southern Mallee in Victoria. He farmed there from the 1890s until he sold his farm in the 1950s.
Wheat and sheep, wasn't he?
Wheat and sheep, yes. He was a particularly careful, quite cautious farmer. And one of the things that really endeared me to him was I could see his sense of humour endeared me to him. A kind of dry, wry sense of humour came through his diaries. But I could see his process of learning and changing through the diaries, and it made me feel like I was growing with him. He started off as quite a cautious, anxious farmer, became alarmed at any sign of dry weather. But you could see as the years went by, as the decades went by, you could see him becoming quite relaxed. He'd sort of look at the weather and think, it's going to be dry. He'd compare it to one of the droughts he'd experienced before, but he really wasn't that fazed because he was so well tuned to the weather that he just knew that droughts were going to come and go, and that was the way it was.
And the other one?
The other one would have to be Margaret McCann.
Dairy and sheep farmer.
She was dairy sheep farmer in Gippsland in Victoria, and she was a sad person, really. You know, when she first arrived at her property, she married into a farming family. She sat on the doorstep and she cried. She was a well-educated woman. She'd emigrated from Ireland. She had been a school teacher before she married, and farming was really not her thing. She would have loved a middle-class life, which in her view meant reading and sewing and sitting in a nice, comfortable house in town. Instead, she had four children. She milked a lot of cows. She helped with the sheep. She had a fairly full-on life, and she died fairly young. I felt for her, yes.
You'd certainly make me think, because as you say, drought is an absence. It's not a cataclysmic event like fire or the incredible stories of flood that we're hearing from the US at the moment. So it's more obscure. It's more demanding of a psyche, isn't it?
I think so. It doesn't have that, you know, immediate adrenaline rush of fearing for your life. You know, drought doesn't kill people, at least not directly. But it's that uncertainty, the intangibility, the fact that you can't actually identify a drought until it's already, you know, 3 or 4 months in. You suddenly realise that you are in drought. You don't know when it's going to end. It's that kind of day in, day out ambiguity of not quite knowing. You know, you get rain during droughts, you know, that's just part of a drought, but you don't know, is this the end of the drought? Is this just a shower? It's that uncertainty. You can never quite plan. You can never quite know what's going on, how long this is going to go on for. There's no clear recovery trajectory. That kind of insidiousness, I think that's really what interested me about drought in the first place.
And as you say, these diaries are used to make note of business transactions, you know, farm transactions. The weather is there, of course, but they're a business tool, so a lot of material. Did anything strike you as unusual when you read them that you weren't really expecting?
One of the things that really struck me was the importance of subsistence and wild harvesting for farmers. By wild harvesting, I mean gathering plants and animals and natural, you know, both native and feral, from the natural environment, not necessarily from the farm environment. And we tend to think of that as something that, you know, the early pioneers did in their, you know, when they first settled, or, you know, we associate it with hunter-gathering, of course. But I was quite astonished that it was an integral part of so many farms, both big and small, not just the sort of small subsistence farmers, right through to the interwar years. And it was a really big part of their household income, and one that has really gone below the radar because, of course, it often contributed to their consumption but not to their cash. So it doesn't appear in statistics and such like.
Right, so these would be possum skins, the kangaroos. I presume they ate the kangaroos. They didn't eat the possums, though, did they, or did they?
No. Margaret McCann, her family were very active in gathering possums. They were sold for cash, and she records the details in her diary.
And wild goats, for instance, as part of that. That was a very definite aspect of life, wasn't it?
And still is, actually. It's interesting that while I think on the whole wild harvesting declined considerably in the interwar years, and by the end of the Second World War was really not much of a feature of farming at all, during the Millennium Drought and ongoing, there's been a resurgence of wild harvesting in semi-arid areas such as Western New South Wales, South Australia, where people are mustering feral goats and selling meat and also live to the Middle East mainly. And it's a huge part of their income now.
You note that Aboriginal people are not singled out in the diaries at all, I don't think. Well, they might be referred to, but they're not easily identified, because you do wonder, particularly in the earlier days of farming, how much input Aboriginal people had, who'd been living, say, with these conditions for thousands of years, what type of advice they may have provided. You know, do you get any hint of this?
Unfortunately, Aboriginal people feature in very few of the diaries that I read. There is one from the 1870s where there's clearly a lot of Aboriginal people working on the pastoral station in Western New South Wales. And on some occasions, the Aboriginal people do come and tell the station owner that they think a flood's coming. And their wisdom is kind of dismissed. It's, oh, yes, yes, Jackie, they were called, of course. You know, whatever, yeah, you know.
And was he right? Better.
He was right.
Really?
He was right. And there was a flood. A flood did come down the Lachlan, and it was quite unfortunate for the pastoral station.
So I suppose what we got from it was that, in a way, the people who survived stopped their thinking of disasters the way we refer to disasters these days. They really, really took into their bones the notion that Australia was an exceptionally volatile climate, and that's just what they'd opted for. When you talk to farmers today, was there a continuum there in attitudes?
I think, unfortunately, we've made ourselves more vulnerable to drought in a way. You know, intuitively, we tend to think that, you know, with global connections and better technology and larger farms, that we're less vulnerable to drought. But I think, in fact, we're a little more vulnerable, because scarcity is so much harder to accommodate these days. A lot has been written about farmers thinking drought's an aberration. None of the farmers I spoke to really thought drought was an aberration. They all accept that drought's a regular part of the climate in Australia. I think that's a given for farmers. But what is more difficult for them is the whole structure of agriculture these days just can't accommodate periods of scarcity. You know, they generally have high debt, high equity, and farms have to have continuous production and even often increasing production in order to service this. And
Marissa, say Charles Coote and his buffer, because the really marvellous thing, I thought the Charles Coote story was just fabulous, and the pictures of him and so on. He always had a buffer, you know, it was a rainy day buffer, as it were, pardon the pun, and it got him through. Now, you're saying that's harder to build into your structure these days?
I think it's very hard, yeah. And that kind of scarcity, which was, it was certainly built into the way farming operated in the past, and it was built into the way society operated in the past, not just farmers. You know, people were accustomed to scarcity. The majority of people didn't have secure employment. The farmers were not that unusual in that they had fluctuating income. Waged people did also, on the whole. And so that kind of scarcity that I think is absolutely integral to Australia's climate was much more part of life then than it is now. And now we're absolutely horrified at the idea of a drop in income,
because it might introduce frugal behaviour, which I think sort of sends shivers down modern people's spines, that word frugal, that adjective. Yes. Look, Rebecca, it's really thought-provoking, really. So thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Rebecca Jones, she's an environmental historian. Her book is Slow Catastrophes, Living with Drought in Australia, and it's published by Monash University Publishing.